Welcome to the reading of the Quad City Times for today, March 27th. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of people with print disabilities. Your readers today are Patty Daniels, and my name is Rachel Mithelman. And here is Patty with our first story.
Thank you. AEA bill goes to governor. Senate approves education legislation, written for us by Aaron Murphy. Des Moines, state general funding for Iowa's K-12 public schools will increase by 2.5%, beginning public teacher salaries will be boosted, and the funding and structure of Iowa's 9 area education agencies will be altered under sweeping education legislation that soon will be signed into law by Governor Kim Reynolds. Iowa Senate Republicans approved the bill Tuesday, giving final legislative blessing to a proposal that realizes, at least partially, a goal set by Reynolds almost 3 months ago during her Condition of the State address. Shortly after the bill passed the Senate, Reynolds' office announced she will sign it into law on Wednesday at the Iowa Capitol. Area education agencies oversee education of Iowa students with disabilities and offer media and consulting services to schools and students within their boundaries. The legislative approval sends a strong message. Every Iowa student deserves a world-class education, and the compensation of every Iowa teacher should reflect the importance of their role, Reynolds said in a statement Tuesday. Over the last several weeks, this bill has been the focus of much discussion and debate. Change is seldom easy, but it is necessary to achieve better results, Reynolds' statement added. Reform the AEA system creates accountability, transparency, consistency, and most importantly, better outcome for all Iowa's students. Only Republicans voted in favor of the legislation, and a few in each chamber voted against it. Democrats said they supported the boost in teacher pay, but voted against the final version of the bill because of how it would alter area education agencies and because they believed the state school funding increase was too low. Currently, federal and state special education funding goes directly to Iowa's 9 area education agencies. AEAs also receive property tax funding for media services and other education services for schools in their region. Once the bill, House File 2612, is fully implemented in the second year, 10% of state funding for special education services will remain with school districts for them to use how they see fit, while 90% will continue to flow directly to the AEAs. In the second year, all state funding for other education services and media services will go directly to schools, which could use that for AEA services or for another entity. The proposal also creates a division in the Iowa Department of Education, up to 53 new full-time equivalent positions, to provide oversight of special education services provided by the AEAs. The bill also establishes a task force to study AEA structure and funding and recommend future changes. The plan has drawn strong opposition from educators and parents of students with disabilities who worry it will hurt special education in the state. Most school superintendents also expressed opposition to the legislation, although some said they are in favor of having more control of their special education dollars. Cindy Yellick, chief administrator of the Heartland AEA in Des Moines, was on hand for the Senate debate and vote at the Iowa Capitol. Afterwards, she said she expects a bumpy few years ahead for area education agencies. I can't really tell you what it's going to look like long term. The timeline to implement the changes is short. The changes are significant, Yellick said. As always, the AEAs will be focused on doing their very best to deliver supports and services to children and families and students and teachers and schools. That is who we are, and we will remain focused on that and do our best to preserve that level of service that we've been known for. Yellick said other AEAs already have seen staff leave because of uncertainty. There's a lot of unknowns, and I can't stand here today and say that people aren't going to feel a difference in the next 3 months, 6 months, a year, Yellick said. But as I say, our long-term goal will always remain with the students. One Republican senator who voted against the bill was Charlie McClintock of Alvernet. He called the proposal universally disliked by both parties. Based on the content and input that I receive, I can say with some confidence that no one really likes this bill, McClintock said during Senate debate. The very idea of dismantling and defunding the area education agencies has upset and offended the people in Iowa to a whole nother level. Democrats also expressed heavy criticism of the bill's AEA provision and accused Republicans of siding with the governor despite pleas from the public. By doing this bill today, what you are saying to your constituents is that they don't matter. What they say doesn't matter. That you serve the governor and not the people. Senator Molly Donahue said, she's a Democrat from Cedar Rapids, has worked for 43 years as a special education teacher. Documents also criticized Republicans adding multiple elements to one bill, AEA's school funding and teacher pay, saying each should have been debated separately. Senator Lynn Evans, Republican from Aurelia and former teacher, principal, and superintendent, said the bill returned special education oversight to the state and would attract more teachers to work in Iowa. This bill in its entirety will not only improve student achievement in special education, it will not only help improve the AEA system, which is a support system for special education and general education, but it's going to raise student achievement in its entirety in our state, Evans said. The 2.3% increase in state general funding for public school districts means an additional $119 million in the 2024-25 school year for a total of $3.8 billion, according to the state's nonpartisan legislative services agency. At that funding level, the number of school districts on the state funding program's budget guarantee, which allows districts to receive funding that would ensure a budget at 101% of the previous year, funded by local property taxes, roughly doubled from 71 districts to 140, more than 43% of districts in the state, according to the agency. We are consistently and continually understanding our public schools every year. We are consistently and continually underfunding our public schools every year, and this bill just makes it worse, Senator Claire Selsey, Democrat of West Des Moines, said during the debate. The minimum salary for first-year teachers in Iowa would increase from the current $33,500 to $47,500 in the 2024-25 school year and $50,000 the next year. Add the minimum salary for teachers with at least 12 years of experience would be set at $60,000 in the upcoming school year and $62,000 the following year. The bill also includes $22 million in the upcoming school year and $23 million the next year to address other veterans to help boost the pay of educational support staff like paraeducators. Those paraeducators work directly with those children, and they form a bond with those children and their children's families, Evans said. There are important, critical people that work with our kids on a daily basis. This is a good addition. And Kaylin McCullough of the League Gazette Des Moines Bureau contributed.
Downtown apartment building is vacated. This by Sarah Watson of the Quad City Times. The city of Davenport vacated an apartment building on West 4th Street on Tuesday on advice of Shive Hattery Structural Engineers. The city is notifying tenants of the building at 401 West 4th Street and has secured available resources to assist in displacement, according to a news release from the city's Development and Neighborhood Services Department Tuesday afternoon. Per the building owner, the current expected number of units that will be vacated is about 18, which the city, in its news release, said is a number it is verifying itself. On Tuesday evening, a few residents could be seen entering and exiting the building with belongings in bags and boxes. Two confirmed to a Quad City Times reporter that they were residents but declined to talk further while they retrieved their belongings. A Davenport police officer was there too. Notices taped to the building's doors told residents the building was being evacuated immediately, and that with proof of residency, rooms would be provided at the Relax Inn on Brady Street from March 26 to March 31st at no cost. Pets would be allowed. The notice advised residents to collect medications, pets, and essential personal belongings. It also advised tenants to contact the Neighborhood Services Department at 563-326-6198 to provide contact information and receive updates and resource assistance. Thomas Owens said he was hired in January to help work on the building, though he has since stopped that work and has been living there. The building is being closed because engineering work that needs to be done on the building has not been done, Owens said. Now a lot of these people have nowhere to go, Owens said. A lot of these people can't go anywhere because of certain circumstances they have. It shouldn't have been like this, he said. They could have given them a couple of days. Schricker BHNVA by SJLLC purchased the property in November of 2022 for $2.125 million, according to online property records. The notices list a New Jersey address for the owners. It was not immediately clear what was wrong with the building to cause an immediate evacuation order by the city. The Quad City Times has requested the findings of the Shive Hattery engineers. As more information becomes available, this will be shared with the public, the city's news release stated. The Schricker apartment building was built in 1906 and has 48 units, according to the Scott County Assessor's website. On May 28th of last year, a six-story apartment building partially collapsed in Davenport and killed three men, caused a woman to lose her leg, and led to dozens of tenants losing their homes and belongings. Since then, the city has faced sharp questions from the public about why the building was not vacated when city inspectors, Mid-American Workers, and a few residents were concerned about the structural integrity of the building. In its wake, city officials said they were relying on a structural engineering report from a firm hired by the building's owner that the building did not need an emergency evacuation order.
Some local news. Road work in Illinois, QC, ramps up. Roadways will have delays and lane closures, written for us by Grace Kinnicott. Construction is beginning around the Illinois Quad Cities. Here is where motorists can expect lane closures and delays. Milan, From now until Monday, April 1st, construction is taking place on the U.S. Highway 67 between Airport Road and 3rd Avenue and on Airport Road between U.S. 67 and Interstate 280. Work includes pavement patching on both roads. One lane of traffic will be open in each direction, the IDOT announcement states. Motorists can expect delays and should allow for extra time through the area. Drivers are also urged to pay close attention to changed conditions and signs in the work zones. Obey the posted speed limits, refrain from using mobile devices, and be alert for workers and equipment. Moline. Construction is set to start April 1 on 19th Street from River Drive to 7th Avenue. The $3.1 million project will convert 19th Street to three lanes, add a 12-foot wide bike path on the east side of the road, and install pedestrian crossings and ADA-compliant sidewalks. The project is partially paid for through the Illinois Transportation Enhancement Program. A news release states, it is the first phase in a multi-phase, multi-year project that will connect the Mississippi River bike path to the Rock River area through the center of Moline. The city is urging motorists to plan ahead. All businesses will remain open during construction. Construction is expected to be completed by November. Traffic signal replacement has been taking place at the intersection of 36th Avenue and 16th Avenue. Replacement is expected to take place through April. Single lane closures are expected throughout the project. Rock Island. Construction on 31st Avenue is expected to start Friday, April 5th. The work zone stretches from Illinois Route 92 or Centennial Expressway to US 67 or 11th Street. Work consists of patching and resurfacing the road. There will be daily lane controls by flaggers. All ramps on Illinois 92 will remain open. Motorists can expect delays and should allow for extra time through the area. Drivers are also urged to pay close attention to changed conditions and signs in the work zones. Obey the posted speed limits and refrain from using mobile devices and be alert for workers and equipment. In a $1.4 million project, it's an Illinois Department of Transportation news release. And one more. The robotics team has season of success. This is written for us by Olivia Allen. Davenport West High School's first robotic competition, FRC, team, Disruptive Innovation number 6317, wrapped up a successful 2023-24 season this month. The team competed at the Central Illinois Regional on March 15th and 16th at Bradley University's Renaissance Coliseum in Peoria, facing 38 teams from Iowa, Illinois, Wisconsin, and Ohio. After 70 qualification matches, the top eight teams select two others to join their alliance. FRC team number 2481 of Tremont chose Disruptive Innovation along with team number 1756 of Peoria. This alliance remained undefeated at the regional. This was Disruptive Innovation's first win at an FRC regional contest, showing the team's hard work and collaboration. Earlier this month, the team also competed on the FRC South Florida Regionals in Fort Lauderdale, competing against 39 teams from Florida, Massachusetts, New York, Texas, Colorado, and Iowa. Disruptive Innovation secured 8th place with an 8-4 record. Additionally, the team earned the FRC's Team Sustainability Award, which highlights a commitment to environmental stewardship and innovation. These competitions have been incredible learning experiences for the students, Coach Greg Smith said in a news release. Winning the Central Illinois Regional was an amazing accomplishment, and being recognized with the Team Sustainability Award at the South Florida Regional further highlights our dedication to excellence and sustainability in robotics. Disruptive Innovations Standout Season underscores the talent and dedication of West Robotics Program, which aims to inspire future generations of engineers and innovators, the district said in the release. First, that's for inspiration and recognition of science and technology, Roberts Competition. It's the first competition, okay. It's an international high school robotics competition where teams must work together to build a robot that can perform in challenging, varied field games.
News from Rock Island, renovation bid okayed. This is by Grace Kinnicott. Downtown Rock Island is about to undergo a multi-million dollar change. Downtown is set to receive $8.7 million in upgrades and improvements, which include changes to Arts Alley, reconstruction of downtown streets, installation of a roundabout, and adding outdoor seating and signage. Valley Construction of Rock Island was awarded the bid. The bid came in $1.7 million higher than the proposed scope from summer of 2023, which estimated it around $7 million, according to previous reporting. Originally, about $2.5 million in American Rescue Plan Act funds were planned for rebuild downtown, but it increased to $3.9 million to help fund water, sewer, and other ARPA qualifying items. Construction is set to begin next month. The project area is Arts Alley, 18th Street from 1st and 3rd Avenues, and 2nd and 3rd Avenues between 18th and 19th Street. First Arts Alley, one of the major components of the Rebuild Downtown Rock Island project, is renovating Arts Alley, located at 1719 2nd Avenue. Jack Cullen, Rock Island Downtown Alliance Executive Director, said Arts Alley would be renovated and would feature two large-scale murals. Combined, there is over 4,000 square feet on the walls surrounding Arts Alley, Cullen said. One of the goals specifically is to come up with something stylistically that doesn't exist anywhere else in the Quad Cities, Cullen said. In January, the Downtown Alliance put out the call for artists to help with the murals in Arts Alley. The murals will be created on separate walls facing each other. The Downtown Alliance is working with Quad City Arts and had over 400 submissions from artists around the world, Cullen said, and the list has been narrowed down to a little more than 130 artists. Decorative string lighting, new signage, and other opportunity for smaller pieces of art also will be featured in the renovation. Arts Alley has a budget of about $534,000, with half of the cost funded by an Illinois tourism attraction grant. The city will fund the remaining costs with a combination of downtown tax increment financing funds and American Rescue Plan Act funds. Next, streetscapes and green space. The parking lot at 18th Street and 2nd Avenue will be removed and replaced with green space. It will have new lighting in the space and Rock Island signage. The space also can be used for yard games and special events. Space for outdoor dining also will be added. 17th Street, near where Theo's Java Cafe and Steve's Old Time Tap are located. 3rd Avenue and 18th Street, near QC Coffee and Pancake House. 2nd Avenue near the former Rock Island Brewing Company, Soy Tu Thai Street Food, and El Patron Mexican. 18th Street near Huckleberry's Great Pizza and Calzones and Nest Cafe. And 17th Street and 2nd Avenue near Rock Island Ale House and Healthy Harvest Urban Farms. The sidewalks in front of the businesses will have the patio space, and fencing would be installed that could be removed during the winter months, Cullen said. Other upgrades and improvements to downtown include a mini roundabout, Welcome to Downtown Rock Island Gateway at First Avenue and 18th Street, street sidewalk and utility construction, electrical landscaping and furnishing construction. Funding sources include $1.5 million from downtown tax increment financing funds, the $3.9 million from ARPA, and a $3 million State of Illinois Rebuild Downtown grant. There also is a contingency of 5%, or $467,000. A full cost breakdown can be found on Monday's Council Study Session presentation and Council agenda. Other million-dollar approval. The Council also approved a $1.6 million bid for City Hall renovations, also from Valley Construction. The bid covers construction costs, with the total project expected to cost around $2.25 million. Of that, $2 million would come from ARPA funds, and $250,000 would come from general fund surplus. The Council also approved $47,000 for asbestos abatement for the renovations. Other project costs include the following: design, $67,880; construction, $1.6 million; audiovisual, $250,000; furniture and fixtures, $200,000. Updates will be made to all three floors with a complete overhaul of the third floor. Renovations for council chambers include a conference room, storage room, new permanent staff seating and flexible public furniture, elevated council seating, restroom upgrades, and upgraded technology. The first floor will have a new reception desk that will replace the display case, new flooring and furniture, an additional office, updated technology, lighting and ceilings, improved security, door removals and addition, and paint and wood refinishing. It also will have a secure entrance to city offices on the first floor. Renovations on the second floor include replacing the ceiling, lighting and furniture, repainting walls, creating a larger waiting area, and improving security and access. Paid for with ARPA funds, a five-year $1.7 million contract with Tyler Technologies also was approved. The contract is for enterprise resource planning. And just this quick note, Jersey Mike's sales today go to Junior Achievement. Three local Jersey Mike's subs location will donate 100% of sales on Wednesday to Junior Achievement of the Heartland. The following Quad City area Jersey Mike's locations will donate each dollar in sales, not just profits, to JA as part of the Nationwide Day of Giving on Wednesday, March 27th. The locations are 3918 16th Street in Moline, 2124 East Kimberly Road in Davenport, and 4451 East 53rd Street in Davenport. Jersey Mike's has partnered with Junior Achievement of the Heartland in this initiative for the past 6 years, raising more than $325,000 to date. JA of the Heartland is based in Moline and supports youth throughout Western Illinois and Eastern Iowa with initiatives on topics like financial literacy and entrepreneurship. Jersey Mike's has gathered customer donations all month for its 14th annual Month of Giving fundraiser at nearly 2,500 locations nationwide, benefiting more than 200 local charities. This year, Jersey Mike's aims to surpass last year's record-breaking $21 million fundraising total. That's amazing. It's time to turn to the obituaries in today's paper. There are several, so Patty and I will take turns reading them. I'll start with the pending services. Elizabeth I. Chapman, age 84, of East Moline, died Tuesday, March 26, cremation directed by Cremation Society of the Quad Cities. Eleanor Patricia Deviney Cook, age 84, of Rock Island, passed away on Saturday, March 23rd. Arrangements are in the care of Went Funeral Home of Moline. Rebecca D. Donahue, age 51, of Middleton, Iowa, died Sunday, March 24th. Funeral arrangements are pending at Trimble Funeral Home and Crematory of Moline. David D. Groharing, age 60, of Byron, Illinois, died Tuesday, March 12th. Arrangements are with Bosma Renkus Funeral Home of Fulton, Illinois. Norma J. Mintier, age 86, of Milan, died Saturday, March 23rd. Whelan Presley Funeral Home and Crematory in Milan is in charge of arrangements. Phyllis B. Reed, age 83, of Rock Island, Illinois, died Tuesday, March 26th. Funeral arrangements are pending at Trimble Funeral Home and Crematory of Moline. And Larry W. Welge, or Welge, not sure which, age 70, of Kelowna, Illinois, died Saturday, March 23rd. Funeral arrangements are pending at Trimble Funeral Home and Crematory of Moline. The first of the obituaries in today's paper comes from Silvis, Carolyn M. McGeehee. Carolyn M. McGeehee, age 92, of Silvis, passed away Monday, March 25th at Friendship Manor in Rock Island. Funeral services will be 11 a.m. Thursday at Trinity Lutheran Church in Moline. Visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m. Wednesday at Schroeder Mortuary in Silvis. Burial will be in Greenview Memorial Gardens, East Moline, at a later date. Memorials may be made to WVIK or Friendship Manor. Carolyn Marie Almer McGeehee was born February 1, 1932, the daughter of Alvin T. and Marie Almer. She graduated from Morton High School, where her father was head of the English department. Following high school, Carolyn attended Augustana College as a history major. She met her forever love, Lane, at Augie while on a blind date and not with each other. They were married June 26, 1954, in Essex, Iowa. Carolyn taught third grade at Riverside Elementary in Riverside, Illinois, until they moved to East Moline in 1959. Carolyn enjoyed entertaining and loved setting a beautiful table and cooking for her family. She also enjoyed reading and was a member of several book and bridge clubs. She served on the Symphony Board, Riverbend Library Board, and PEO Chapter HB in Moline. Carolyn was a member of Trinity Lutheran Church, where she was active on the luncheon committee. She enjoyed adventures, including white water rafting at the age of 70. She also enjoyed traveling to her lake home in Minnesota and spending time with her family. Survivors include her children, Anne McGeehee of Rock Island and John's spouse Linda McGeehee of Moline. Grandchildren Sean, Nicole, Chloe, and Jonathan, and five great-grandchildren. Carolyn was preceded in death by her parents and her husband. Online condolences may be made at schroedermortuary.com.
Ruth Gunther, March 6, 1929 to March 14, 2024. Ruth Gunther, 95, of Columbus Junction, passed away Sunday, March 24. Services will be held at 10 a.m. on Saturday, March 30th at the Runge Mortuary. Visitation will begin at 9 a.m. She will be laid to rest in Rose Hill Cemetery in Buffalo. Memorials may be made to Senior Resources of Muscatine. Online condolences may be expressed at Runge Mortuary. Ruth was born March 6, 1929, to Charles and Emma Wessel Swift in Davenport. She was a cheerleader and a homecoming queen runner-up at Davenport Central High School. Ruth had worked as a telephone operator at Northwest Bell Telephone Company, Day's Pharmacy, Model Dairy, and Sheriff's Department Store. Her last job was Sue Hamilton's Sue Hallmark Shop. On October 8, 1949, she married Marvin Gunther at St. Mark's Church in Davenport. They started a family and had three children. She was a member of Pythian Sisters Banner Temple, number 49, Quad Cities, plus 60. Mercy Silver Service, Jackson County Historical Society, PTA, Firemen's Auxiliary, Den Mother, Bluebird Leader, Sunday School Teacher, an avid member of Calvary Lutheran Church, and the Pleasant Grove Church, where she was a member of the Pleasant Grove Ladies Auxiliary. She and Melvin moved to Columbus Junction in 1976, where they raised assorted animals, had a large garden and strawberry patch, canned a variety of vegetables, and put their prized produce in the local fair. Ruth was an avid stamp collector and family historian. The family would gather on holidays at her house, especially at Christmas, when she would make her famous German potato salad. She is survived by her children, Melody, Gavin, and grandchildren, Deanna, Jared, Brianna, Laura, Eric, Kyle, Lindsay, and Cody, 15 great-grandchildren, and sister Shirley Vansland. She was preceded in death by siblings Milburn Swift and Dale Swift. Logan A. Kepi, June 2nd, 2001 to March 23rd, 2024. Logan A. Kepi, 22, of Davenport, passed away Saturday, March 23rd at the University of Iowa Hospital due to a quick diagnosis and hard-fought battle with cancer. Logan was born June 2nd, 2001 in Silvis, Illinois, to Nick Kepi and Jessica Williams. Logan enjoyed working at Kepi Lawn and Landscape with his dad, being outdoors, and the smell of fresh-cut grass. Some of Logan's favorite hobbies included baseball, camping, playing Xbox, and going to the fairgrounds to watch stock car races with his best friends. Logan had a love for all kinds of animals, but most importantly, his two dogs, Dallas and Chase. Logan was a very kind and caring person. He loved helping his grandma Lois with day-to-day activities and anything she needed during the holidays, as well as his lunch dates with Grandma Tina. Logan enjoyed hanging out at Club T's, watching Chicago Fire, and being around as many family and friends as possible, but especially his two best friends, Wyatt Swearinger and Ian Foote. Survivors include his father, Nicholas Kepi, Jessica Williams, Silvis, sisters Nicolette, Nita, and Calliope, brothers Aiden, Liam, Sean, and Hunter, grandparents Lois Kepi, Tina, and Craig Duncan, many aunts, uncles, and cousins. Logan was preceded in death by his grandpa, Carrie Kepi, great-grandmother Mary Nana Munoz, Jose Papa Munoz, uncle Joe Munoz, cousin Natalie Munoz, and his favorite dog, Duke. There will be a visitation from 12 p.m. to 2 p.m. Thursday, March 28th at the Runge Mortuary and Crematory. Logan's funeral service will follow at 2 p.m. in the Runge Mortuary Chapel, with cremation to follow. Memorials may be made to his GoFundMe account, gofundme.com/F/help-support-Logan-during-his-battle. All of these have hyphens. Help support Logan during his battle with cancer. Condolences for the family may be shared at runchmortuary.com.
Next, from Clarence, in memory of Robert F. Miller. Robert F. Miller, age 93 of Clarence, passed away on Monday, March 25th at the Clarence Nursing Home. Funeral services will be held on Friday, March 29th at 2:30 p.m. at St. John's United Church of Christ in Clarence, with Janet Shotwell officiating. Visitation will be from 1 p.m. until service time at the church. Burial will be in St. John's Cemetery with military rites. Bob was born September 14, 1930, in Cedar County to Fred and Louise Miller. He married Catherine Kinsel on February 15, 1953, in Clarence. She passed away on March 10, 2016. He is survived by his son, Scott of San Antonio, daughters Debbie of Minnesota and Diane of Loudoun, grandchildren Kyle, Chris, and Megan, and great-grandchildren. He was preceded in death by his parents, wife, and sisters Donna and Dorothy. After graduating from Clarence High School, Bob honorably served his country in the Navy during the Korean War, and was stationed in Bremerton, Washington, San Diego, California, and Hawaii. Bob drove a Sinclair tanker truck before accepting the role as postmaster in the Clarence Post Office, where he retired. He enjoyed traveling to Myrtle Beach and postmaster conventions with his wife, his grandkids and great-grandkids' sporting events, and watching the Cubs or Iowa Hawkeyes. Bob was a member of the Clarence American Legion, St. John's UCC, where he was a Sunday school teacher in his earlier years, and was a past member of the Clarence Volunteer Fire Department. He also truly enjoyed his social hour with his buddies. Memories and condolences may be left at chapman-fh.com. Next, from Moline, Julie Annette Foster. Julie Annette Foster, age 60, much-loved sister, aunt, and friend, died peacefully on Sunday, March 17th, in her home in Moline. She was born February 14th, 1964, in Aledo, Illinois, the daughter of Raymond and Patricia Foster. Julie spent her youth in Princeton, Illinois. Her love of horses led her to a job at Kiowa Acres. She was active in concert choir and the Madrigal Singers in Princeton High School. After graduating high school in 1982, Julie attended Illinois Wesleyan University in Bloomington, Illinois, and Columbia College in Chicago, Illinois, where she focused on her love of music. For about 10 years, Julie worked as a nanny in Illinois and in Maryland, which allowed her to travel to Europe. Upon returning to the Quad City area, she worked as a pharmacy technician for Walgreens until her retirement in 2020. She enjoyed photography, reading, music, especially opera, and her cockatiel named Pumpkin. Julie is survived by her three siblings, Ray Foster of Rock Island, Paul Foster of Arizona, Carol Foster also of Arizona, two nieces, Megan and Nicole, one nephew, Xavier, as well as three grandnieces. She leaves behind numerous loving relatives. Preceding her in death are her mother and father, Patricia and Raymond Foster, grandparents, an aunt, and two uncles. A celebration of life will be held in Illinois at a later date. Arrangements were provided by Wendt Funeral Home in Moline, and online condolences can be left at the Wendt Funeral Home website. And finally, Donald Dean Snyder. Donald Dean Snyder, age 82, passed away peacefully at his home on March 23rd after a hard-fought battle with Parkinson's, heart disease, and COPD after being exposed to Agent Orange in the Vietnam War. Don was born on September 1st, 1941, in Davenport. He grew up with six brothers and sisters, David, Mary Lou, Betty, John, Bill, and Wayne. Don graduated from Davenport High, the last graduating class of Davenport High before it was renamed Davenport Central High. After graduation, he went to work for Cartridge Pack as a machinist, where he worked for 43 years until he retired in 2001. Don married Nancy Stone in 1966. 10 months after they were married, Don was drafted into the Army to serve in the Vietnam War, where he served for 2 years. Don and Nancy had 3 children, James or Jamie, Bethany, and Matthew or Matt. Don was no ordinary father. He was an extraordinary father. He could always be found playing ball with his kids and their neighborhood friends. He coached almost every sport that his kids played and was actively involved in all their activities. Don instilled the value of having a strong work ethic in his children from a very young age and taught them to work hard for the things they need and want in life. "If you can't afford to pay cash for it," he said, "you don't need it." Don enjoyed many things through the years, softball in beer leagues, bowling, maintaining a bright green lawn, and working with his hands. There wasn't much that he couldn't fix. He was an avid fisherman, amateur golfer, and a professional smartass. Don was an outstanding cook and will always be remembered by his kids and grandchildren for his famous cinnamon toast. Don and Nancy shared a beautiful life together. They were married for almost 58 years, and their marriage was a role model of love, compromise, support, commitment, friendship, and teamwork. They were constantly laughing and pranking one another. Throughout their life together, they shared a love of gambling trips, antique auctions, car shows in his Corvette, and playing cards with friends and family. Don was preceded in death by his parents, Darvin and Marie, his brother John, and sisters Mary Lou and Betty. He is survived by his wife Nancy, his children Jamie, Bethany, and Matt, 9 beautiful grandchildren, and 1 great-granddaughter. Don also leaves behind 3 brothers and their families, a large extended family and numerous friends that he loved so dearly. Funeral arrangements will be held at Rungi Mortuary in Davenport on Saturday, March 30th. Visitation will be held from 11 to 2, with a service to follow at 2 p.m. It's time to turn to the opinion page of the Quad City Times, and here is Patty with the first article.
Thanks, Rachel. Trump is already losing to Biden in a big way. Written for us by Eugene Robinson from the Washington Post. Donald Trump has always loved to boast about how much money he has, or claims to have. When he announced his presidential run in 2015, he pledged to self-finance his campaign and crowed, "I don't need anybody's money." He sure needs some now. President Joe Biden's re-election campaign reported Wednesday that it has $71 million in cash on hand, more than double the $33.5 million that Trump's campaign reported having. If you throw in the bank balances of affiliated groups supporting the candidates, Trump's campaign liquidity rises to $42 million. But Biden soars to a stunning $155 million, a ridiculous amount for this point in the cycle. It makes me wonder about all these stories telling us how unenthusiastic Democrats are about Biden's reelection. I'm starting to think that maybe, hear me out, we should pay less attention to what people say and more to what they actually do. The Republican National Committee is in no position to bail out the Trump campaign. It reported raising $10.7 million in February, ending the month with $11.3 million in the bank. But the Democratic National Committee raised $16.6 million in February and was left with $26.6 million in cash on hand. No wonder that Trump sent daughter-in-law Laura Trump over to the RNC to try to improve the balance sheet. The Biden campaign can be excused for a bit of chest thumping. If Donald Trump put up these kinds of numbers on The Apprentice, communications director Michael Tyler said in a statement, he'd fire himself. At this moment, of course, campaign cash might be the least of Trump's money concerns. His lawyers told a New York court this week that the former president has been unable to secure a bond that would give him time to appeal a $454 million judgment against him. And his company for fraud, and there's an editor's note here, since the writing of this, the bond has been lowered to $175 million to be paid in 10 days. Trump approached more than 30 companies about underwriting the bond, his lawyer said, but all refused to accept real estate as collateral, and real estate is the source of most of Trump's wealth. The insurance from Chubb, the insurance firm Chubb did underwrite a $91 million bond for Trump to appeal a separate civil judgment for defaming writer E. Jean Carroll, but decided to steer clear of the fraud case. New York Attorney General Letitia James could theoretically begin seizing Trump's assets as soon as next week if he is unable to secure and post a bond. It would surely be galling for Trump to lose his gaudy triplex apartment in Manhattan's Trump Tower, where he famously descended the escalator in 2015 to announce he was running for president. Declaring bankruptcy is the one remedy guaranteed to keep the wolf away from Trump's lavishly gilded door, but he has reportedly ruled it out. That would likely give him years of breathing room on the massive fines, which Trump should know, given his past. He has used bankruptcy six times, largely to get out from under his foolish and ruinous foray into this casino business in Atlantic City. Of course, filing for bankruptcy in the middle of a campaign would threaten Trump's image as a successful, respected businessman. The Washington Post quoted a source close to Trump as saying he'd rather have Letitia Brown, James show up with the sheriff at 40 Wall, a Trump office tower, and make a huge stink about it than say he's bankrupt. Trump's personal cash crunch is relevant because the campaign is helping to pay the soaring legal bills that he and his associates and co-defendants in the criminal case are racking up. Trump's Save America Political Action Committee has spent $8.5 million on legal costs since the beginning of the year. The campaign itself has paid an additional $1.8 million to lawyers. So far, the RNC's position has been that it will not use Republican Party funds to pay Trump's legal bills. But a resolution that would have made this stance official failed to win enough support to make it to the floor of the recent RNC meeting. Watch as they do and not as they say. And Washington Post is where Robinson writes.
There is another editorial, but we're running short on time, so I'm going to read the two letters to the editor in today's paper. Affordable Care Act brought health care to millions. Time to celebrate. The Affordable Care Act, or known as Obamacare, is celebrating its birthday. This historic act improved the health of Americans. Millions have access to preventive and rehabilitative care, prescription drugs, contraceptives, mental health care, and treatment for substance abuse. Lives are saved. Families can access care for their children. Young people up to age 26 are covered. Health care plans must cover preventive health services for breast and cervical cancer for women that previously were considered optional. Prenatal care coverage is required. ACA is a win for people with disabilities. Plans cannot discriminate based on pre-existing conditions and eliminated lifetime payment caps. Can you imagine that these necessary services were not covered before 2010? My mother did not have health insurance most of her life. When she aged into Medicare, it was discovered that she had stage 4 colon cancer. It was determined that her tumor had been growing for 10 years. Having affordable health care during her working years could have prevented the growth of the tumor. Medicare treatments did extend her life several years. A close family member has a pre-existing condition that before ACA would have prevented her being insurable. Extreme Republicans like Marinette Miller-Meeks want to turn back the clock on ACA and Medicare. Miller-Meeks will kill them. These two programs are the most successful that benefit the health of Americans. Stop. Think how ACA and Medicare have benefited your loved ones. Vote like your life depends on it, as it does. Signed, Susan Stofen of New Liberty. And then, this is not your usual letter to the editor. As I was watching the women's Big Ten title game at the Target Center in Minneapolis, I was thinking that last year Steve Batterson was covering the Iowa women's team as they won the Big Ten tourney title, and then their journey to the Final Four in Dallas, where they fell in the title game to LSU. Watching the Iowa women come from behind to defeat Nebraska in the title game in overtime, the score was 94-89. I thought to myself, Steve was still somewhere in the Target Center watching Caitlin Clark and the Hawks come from behind. During Caitlin Clark not only became an Iowa State icon, but also a nationally known player. That was because people like Steve Batterson covered her before she played her first game for Lisa Bluter. Caitlin Clark is someone who comes along once in a lifetime, but I think that Steve Batterson was also one of a kind. That is signed by Dave Fuller of Davenport. That brings us to the end of the Quad City Times for today. My name is Rachel Mithelman, and my partner at the microphone has been Patty Daniels. You can listen to IRIS programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowaradioreading.org. Thank you for listening to IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.